thanks a lot for the invite. This isn't my coat. So we think about animals, I think, in quite strange ways. We tend to clarify them and simplify them and in a way objectify them until they become stereotypes of what we think they should be. And we ascribe them to a point personalities. And I'm not afraid of anthropomorphism. I'm a vet, and I've published a lot of science, which has to be fully referenced and attempts to be logical. But I also think it's quite legitimate for us to try and put ourselves inside the heads of animals, because animals try and put themselves inside the heads of humans. If you've got a dog, your dog's looking at what you're doing and predicting what you're going to do. So I think, to a certain extent, we shouldn't be afraid to anthropomorphize things that we see in animals. And the world is full of hybrids of animals and humans, sometimes for humorous purposes and sometimes sort of more instrumentally to try and tell us something about ourselves or about animals. And of course, the association between animals and humans is quite intimate. It's about care, it's about affection, it's about consumption, it's about many of these things. And we live in a world in which you may attempt to have a minimal impact on animals, but humans around you are having an enormous impact on animals in the wild world, in the farmed world. So I'll talk about some of these issues in relation to sex, reproduction. Some of the things we've done with animals have reached quite an extraordinary level. This is a Belgian blue cow. And the musculature of this cow has reached such a fantastic level now that it cannot reproduce to a certain extent normally now. Many of the calves have to be born by a cesarean section. So I think humans have taken control and manipulation to a very high level, including control of reproduction, of sexual behaviours in animals, which is what we're going to try and cover in this talk. And many of the animals that I'm going to describe will end up as meat. So many people would say, well, does it matter? If the animal's life is relatively short, if its time on the planet is curtailed, does it really matter if it doesn't mate, breed, fall in love, all these kind of things? If within a very short period of time it's going to be a sausage? And I think those are questions that we shouldn't be afraid to tackle, really. When we create so many animals for our purposes and then we give them lives that are very much under our control, I think it's legitimate that we ask questions about the sort of the arc of their lives and whether the arc of their lives is an arc that we would recognise in a fully formed life, in a human life, maybe. I think some things are surprising. They're not quite what you anticipate. I was standing by the... I might have to put my finger on the screen. I was standing by the side of a field. I was standing by the side of a field in New Zealand a little while ago. Nothing's going to happen there. And I saw this. Is it going to play? We even tried this earlier, and it worked then.
Has it gone to the end?
I don't think so. Okay. Well, we'll give up on that. Sorry. Technology can let you down when you don't want it to. Okay. So what we tend to do in animals, particularly in production animals, we have a terminology. This terminological coating that I've used as a title. We avoid many of the words that we would use if we're describing human interactions, especially human sexual interactions. We talk about things like breeding and mating and rearing and propagation and replication. And the focus tends to be on productivity, on things that have outcomes that you can measure, percentages, how many lambs a sheep will produce. But what I think is lacking, and what I'd like to discuss and hopefully conclude, is that there are many aspects of an interaction between animals and to a certain point between humans that are lost in the language that we use in production science. So first of all, something about the mechanics of of intercourse in animals, and not surprisingly, it's very similar to that we're familiar with in humans. But we dress descriptions of it in a biological and productive way. We avoid reference to the more emotional, interactive, sexual terminology that we reserve almost exclusively for humans. So, just the nuts and bolts. Most of the species that we're discussing here have a female side and a male side. And fundamentally, one part goes inside the other. And after some kind of activity, short or long, or exciting or non-exciting for the recipients, or maybe even for the observer, there'll be something produced. And the something that's produced is a living thing. From the female, it's an ova, and from the male, it's sperm. So all the activity that comes before that, in a reproductive sense, is about producing this stuff. But that's not to undermine the importance of what comes before. We all started here. It's not something we think about all the time, that we spent those months in a uterus, that we had a voyage down a vagina. We don't think about that actively, but we all did. And nearly every animal that we're going to be discussing had roughly the same journey. So and I will say this many times, it seems surprising then that people would say that animals are so different from humans that their emotional experiences are likely to be far outside of our human experience. I think that's very unlikely, and I'll say that again and again. So for many animals, particularly mammals, which we come more closely associated with, the act is fundamentally the same. The physical act is fundamentally the same, but we use a very different language. So let's go through the mechanics. Not starting with mammals, let's start with worms. And in fact, it's a little bit of a difficult example, this, because it's difficult to tell which is the male and the female. And in this case, it's possible that they're both a male and a female at the same time, as would be the case perhaps in snails. So there are some species in which even the gender separation is subtle, and maybe even change. Some fish, the fish will change gender halfway through their life. So gender is to a point important but unimportant in some species. But when we think of sex, we think it's a fairly short-lived activity, in the majority of cases. But for a snail or for a worm, sex can be hours, if not days, in duration. For some animals like octopus, squid, sex is also very, very much linked with a courtship, with choice of a partner. But then the sexual act itself is, we would perceive, rather odd. It's passage of a sperm packet by an arm. So the arm of the male reaches into a little vacuole in the side of the male, grabs a sperm packet, and then inserts it through the siphon, which is part of the respiratory system of the octopus, and inserts it in close to the ovaries. So there's no reproductive organ per se, it's a passage of a packet. But it's intimately linked with a courtship, with a lot of behaviors. So some of the things that we take for granted, sort of intromission, a penis going into a vagina equivalent, they don't even exist in some species. But that's not to say that the behaviors, the interaction, are not quite interesting and complex and subtle. This wasn't taken in my pond, but if any of you have got ponds, about a month ago, the mating of the frogs took place, and it's quite a thing, really. It's the biggest gangbang you've ever seen. And it's difficult to tell if it's even voluntary. I'm sure it is to a point voluntary, but there'll be one female with four males on. But the key thing is that it seems that it's an intimate process in what you might consider to be a rather uncomplicated animal. I think many animals are very complicated. But choices are made, and animals spend a lot of time in an intimate embrace. It's not about beauty. You don't have to be beautiful necessarily. And then we come to things that perhaps we're a little bit more closely aligned with. If any of you have had backyard chickens or cat birds of any sort, you all know that mating is a key part. But it's often cyclic, it's often seasonal, it's not the whole year round. And I don't know if you know, but for instance, a female hen can lay fertile eggs continue to lay fertile eggs for weeks after one mating, because the male can deposit living sperm inside the female that the female then gives nutrition to. She has a little vesicle off her reproductive tract that actually keeps sperm alive for weeks and weeks. So she does not have to be mated every time she lays a fertile egg. So there are some things in the animal world that are quite distant from us. I mean, for instance, if you went up to a party and you came back and you had sex, and then you were going to be fertile as a result of that for 2 months, it may change your whole view on the caution with which you would like to, you know, involve in that, yourself in that. So the mechanics of sex and reproduction are fairly consistent in most of the species that we're considering anyway. There will be a male, there will be a female, there will be some kind of courtship in general. There will be some preparation, there will be some signalling between both the parties, and often the female will signal that she's receptive. If she doesn't signal that she's receptive, in some things that we do in the farming world, that doesn't stop it from happening, and I'll come to that in a minute. And as closer you get to the mammals, the closer it resembles what we perceive of as sexual activity, sometimes prolonged, sometimes short. The canids are quite interesting. Have any of you ever mated a bitch and a dog? None of you have had a litter of puppies. Yes? Did you own the bitch or the dog or?
Both.
Both, okay. So what I'm going to show you now, you won't be surprised about, I mean, you won't be surprised about this, which is the mating activity. But the male dog has two things that males of the human species, but males of quite a lot of species do have. First of all, the male in the dog has a bone in his penis, which means he can maintain an erection for a long period of time. The other thing, and this is the bone called the os penis, it's also found in quite a lot of other mammals. It's found in a lot of marine mammals, in cetacea, that's the whales and dolphins. So it enables them to maintain an erection for a long, long period of time. And this is the erect penis of the dog. There's also an interesting feature here, that it swells not only across its entire leg, it swells at the root as well. And what the function of this is, do you know what I'm gonna say? Did you see this happen? Did you see this happen?
Yeah.
Do you know what it's called?
No.
This is called tying. And this is an indicator of successful mating in the dog. And what's happened is this swelling, when the mating has been successful, will tie the male to the female for quite a long period of time. You cannot pull them apart. You can try, but many people do. They say, well, what horrendous thing is happening here? These dogs have somehow fused together in a weird way. I mean, it's a perfectly natural phenomenon. It just means that the sperm transfer is complete. So successful mating in the dog is followed by this process called tying. Do you remember that? And it happened, did it?
Yeah.
Okay. The cat, I mean, many of you have got cats and probably haven't given this any thought at all, but actually mating in the cat is quite a complicated process. There'll be lots of pre-activity, and when the female, you've probably heard it at night, when the female's receptive, she becomes something that you didn't anticipate she would become. She's a very show-offy kind of a thing. And the male, the penis of the cat, has barbs on it. It's quite a robust looking thing. So animals very close to home, the dog and the cat, have some mating activity and reproductive and anatomical features that you probably haven't given a moment's thought to, but in a way are quite odd. Odd in relation to our experience of this kind of thing. The farm species, which I'm going to focus on quite a bit because I am predominantly a farm vet, it falls into two schools really, whether we allow these animals to mate in a semi-natural way or whether we don't. Quite a lot of we do is about what we do in farm animals. It's about taking control of the whole mating process for our own ends, for our own selection purposes, for genetic selection, for other selection. These are actually Przeworski's horses, but it's the same as any other kind of equine mating. And some species, in a way, are more recognisable to us in their mating behaviours. These are two dolphins. And to mate dolphins, they spend a long time doing it, but they must voluntarily allow each other to breathe, because one of them will be upside down, effectively. So this has got to be a very mutually agreed thing, where breathing and diving is all part of the activity. The scale of the event is also quite large, shall I say. Some behaviours of mammals are very pronounced. When females are reproductively available in some of the primates, the changes in their genitals are really pronounced, to the point of almost looking bizarre to us. And in fact, sometimes the signalling is not in the just in the genitals. In this case, in these particular monkeys, the signalling is also on the chest. And then I think where the analogies to the way that we think about sex are the closest are in the bonobos, in the chimps, in the gorillas, to a certain extent in the orangutan, where we see behaviours that it's very hard, in my opinion, to differentiate from the behaviours that we partake in. Long courtships, sexual jealousy, partner changes, and some of the sex is in a much more recognisable form to that we would say is part of conventional human repertoire. Okay, so I'm now going to talk about how humans control or manipulate sexual activity in animals, because I think it tells us a lot about how we see animals and whether we think sexual behaviour in animals is should be valued at all. And I'm going to start with the least profound, and I'm going to move towards the more profound sort of controls that we have of animals. So the first is we just physically prevent it. So chastity type things, they're never called that. They're called mate stop or boy away or something nice like that, you know. But they are simply physical preventions for mating activity. Because in the bitch who is she's called polyester, she cycles perhaps twice a year. Then for the owner who doesn't want that bitch to become pregnant, physical protection is one mechanism. But this is pretty uncommon in the animal world, in the kept animal world, because to do this for a large number of animals, for a whole flock of sheep or for a whole herd of cattle, would be pretty hard. So we don't tend to do that. You can, of course, try less aversive things like anti-mating smells, but the intention to mate, the wish to mate, in both the female and the male in the dog is extremely strong. And they will try and overcome it, despite all your efforts. So I just thought I'd mention a little bit that even if we put animals in single-sex groups, it's possible that our manipulations are not as successful as we think. But also we can use separated sex as a way of determining who's receptive for reproduction. So we call this teasing. And this doesn't mean this. This doesn't mean like flirting. Well, it does. Well, it does and it doesn't. You'll see what I mean. A teaser is not this thing, which, if anyone's a guitarist, is a kind of foot pedal thing you can get called a teaser. It's not that either. It's this. It's where you particularly choose to use a male, but you compromise his ability to perform. So you put something on him, in this case, a big harness, so that he can show interest in a female, but he could not perform. He could not impregnate and make the female pregnant. So you can use him as a teaser. Here's a teaser here. So you take his stallion and you take the mare and you think she's likely to be receptive and you take the stallion close and she shows, I'll show you later how she shows. She shows whether she is truly receptive or not, but he represents no risk at all. So this is the frustrating world of the teaser. And his professional job is to be interested but not to perform. Now, if the female is interested in the mare, she shows very clearly, this is a behavior called flamen, where she shows, yes, I'm quite interested, I like him. I mean, he's wearing this strange harness, but you know, I still kind of like him. So this flamen thing with the lips is one thing. The other, maybe you knew about this or maybe not, but it's a key part of equine reproductive control and understanding, is this thing called vulval winking, where if the female is receptive, she'll lift her tail, she'll urinate, but she'll also wink her vulva. So here's some still pictures of her winking her vulva, and here's a rather strange animation of her doing it. So there are some behaviours which, if you try to explain this, other than purely anatomical, behavioural use for reproductive purposes, would seem, in a way, odd. But in the world of those animals, it's more than normal. It's very much part of the signaling, sort of reciprocal thing that says, yes, I'm available, I'm receptive, yes. So these animals called teasers are a part of many reproductive systems. You see them in sheep, you see them in horses, and they're used to get close to sex, but not to permit sex. They're used to identify animals that then you can choose to do with, in a more controlled way, what you want. And if you choose then to choose another stallion, or more commonly, to take the mare to another stallion, so you find out that she's receptive using a teaser, and then you put her in a horse box and you take her to the high-value stallion. So in a way, you've taken control of the whole natural aspects of this. As I said, it happens in sheep as well. So this is a teaser ram, poor chap. He's been put into the flock, and he indicates which of the ewes will be receptive. And then either those ewes are used for artificial insemination, which I'll come to in a minute, or you choose more selectively which ram you're going to use. So this is the next profound stage, which is choose who and when can partake in sexual activity. So the first thing is you choose the chosen ones carefully. I mean, you do things like measure the size of the testicles and measure the back fat composition of the female. I mean, this is mechanistically harsh. This is about getting maximum performance. So you choose the recipient, the pairs carefully. And then you make sure you know who did what with what. So these are called raddles, and on them they have a crayon. And so this is so that you know who is mated with who. And in this case, they're both the same color, but it's very often different colors. So you may not have even known noticed what it is, but if you go into the countryside and see sheep in the autumn, you'll often see they've got different colors on their rumps. Those colours indicate who they've been mated by, and that's what's called a raddle crayon. And it gives you control to a certain point on who is mating with who and who is going to have lambs by who. The equine world is highly controlled because of the value of the animal. So here's a mare being prepared for mating. She may or may not have said, yes, I'm content with this stallion. But it doesn't really matter. In the stud system, they will persevere to a large degree until she effectively capitulates. And you see how she's protected. She's protected against bites. He will bite her. She's protected against kicks. She's also got her feet in little shoes here so that if she kicks him, he's protected because he's valuable. She's valuable also to protect the people. So the whole thing is highly controlled, in a way highly contrived. I mean, it's intercourse, it's reproduction, it's sex in a highly controlled environment and with one aim only, and that's to get a foal. I mean, even the room is padded. So the next thing is remove either one or both of the, remove one of the sexes so natural mating is not at all possible. But before I do that, I'd just like to point out to you that actually some of the homosexual stroke unisexual, i.e. the masturbatory activity that we recognise, accept, take for granted, enjoy as humans, quite common in some species of animals as well, particularly so as you get in a way closer to behaviours that we would recognise. So here in a bonobo, female masturbation is quite common. Wouldn't serve any direct reproductive function, but perhaps and very likely if you're willing to anthropomorphize, put yourself into their perspective, would seem that serve the same functions that it would for us. Comfort, reassurance, being part of a sexual, circular sexual activity. But homosexuality in animals is common and uncommon. There are some species where it's well recognised. In lions it's quite well recognised, sometimes mistakenly associated with X, Y or Z. It can happen in females as well. Female on female sexual activity is not uncommon and can still take place even if there are males present. And this is a behaviour that you may have seen in the fields. This is what's called bullying behaviour in cattle, but there are no bulls to be seen. This is a cow and this is a cow, they're both females. But this cow is signalling that this cow is reproductively available, bullying as we call it. So what the farmer looks for is the interest of the other females in this cow, and then he takes this cow out of the herd and puts it with a bull or serves it using artificial insemination. So this same-sex behaviour is actually a routine part of farm activity in every dairy herd. I think someone's talking about dairy herds. Who's the? So you're very familiar with bulling activity, are you?
Yeah, I've seen it.
And it's absolutely the normal, but when you think about it, it's a little bit odd that we make a behaviour like this, a homosexual behaviour, a key part of our reproductive controlling of dairy cattle, for instance. So look out for it when you're in the field next. And if you see it, that's what it is. It's the cow that's being ridden is in general, but not always, is in general the cow that's the receptive cow. And then what we do very commonly for farm animals is we put them in single-sex groups. So we put them in flocks or herds with only one sex. Well, okay, sorry about that. And we do that totally to enable us to control when and where and who. But there are some philosophical difficulties with this. I'm particularly interested in poultry, and we put poultry in not only single sex groups, but single age groups. We do this for pigs as well. So you may not have given this any thought at all, but if you went to school, if your parents waved goodbye to you on the moment you were born, and then you were incubated with a group of other young chicklet people, all of the same age, and then sent out into the world where all of you were born on the same day, it would be like entering the world without a manual. You'd have to either learn everything yourself or use your innate inherent knowledge. Because this is what happens to groups of animals that are reared and kept in single age groups. They don't learn anything. There is no transmission of taught knowledge from generation to generation at all, nothing. So they have to learn all the behaviors, feeding, nesting, sexual behaviors, by trial and error, by first principle, or by their innate knowledge. So I hope my videos will work. You down a go? I don't know why they won't work, because they worked earlier when we tried them, didn't they? No, it's not down a go. Okay, well what it is, it's a group of ducks. And there's one I did want to show you, because it's a really, really nice one. It's a group of ducks, and a whole shed full of ducks. But what you have to remember is that they will not only not have learned anything from a previous generation, they cannot transmit anything to another generation. They will be eaten without transmitting any learned knowledge to the next generation. So you might say, well, what's this got to do with our discussion about sex? Well, I have a concern. Oh, okay. I have a concern that this eventually, given long enough, would mean a lot of the innate knowledge, particularly in pigs and poultry, would actually be lost, because there's no reinforcement of it. There's no need for an animal to transmit knowledge on nesting or mating or effective feeding or breeding if that's completely taken control of by people. So it might be too philosophical, but I spend a lot of time, predominantly a poultry vet actually. I go all around the world doing poultry stuff, and when I raise this question with farmers, they look at me as if I got a little bit mad, because it's so far out of their ken, out of their sort of their general domain of interest. They're interested in production and economics of production. They're not really interested in the philosophy of when you've done this cycling 100 or 1,000 times. But I think it represents a profound risk to what we're doing in animals in the world, in the future anyway. Because it's a bit like this. When you go to school, you learn things from your peers, you learn games. They're not generally taught to you by teachers. So this knowledge is cycled within an age group. And that's fine, as long as that age group can communicate it to the next age group. As soon as it can't, I think some of these fundamental aspects of an animal's life could be lost. And you might say, well, okay, that's only for farmed animals. But actually, farmed animals are becoming the dominant animals of the planet now. So the next level of profoundness, I think, comes where we take control of not the sex. Well, we do. We take control of the sex, because what we want are the products of the sex. We want the semen and we want the eggs. So this is the world of artificial insemination. You've got to collect some sperm. You can then do funny things with it. If you want, you can dilute it. I mean, many cows out there have never seen a bull. they've seen some diluted sperm. So one bull might have actually resulted in 5,000, 10,000 calves because of the capacity to dilute that sperm and spread it across an enormous population. Anyway, this is artificial insemination. The first semi-sexual activity is you need to collect some semen. So you create something that's a collection device. And then you, the human, engage in some partial activity that will result in production of some semen. So this is common across all the species. This is a dog. This, surprisingly, is a cat. This is a horse. I mean, when you get up to horse scale, it gets rather epic and quite dangerous. Because these animals are not only strong and big and heavy, but also sexually excited at the time when you're doing this. So these things are done in quite protected environments. You wear a hard hat, you often wear boots. So this is semen collection. And it's a whole industry. You can buy high value equine semen, or you can buy bull semen if you want to. There's no restriction. And it's kept in liquid nitrogen. You could go on the internet and say, I'd like 100 straws of this bull semen. And there will be no restriction on you buying it, for instance. So this is the world of artificial insemination, but sometimes it's semi-interactive. In this case, the stallion has got sight of a mare. I mean, that's as close as he's going to get. But there is a mare there to make the activity more, shall we say, focused. There's a mare here in this picture. She's protected. She's not directly involved at all, but she's there to motivate the stallion. Pigs, chickens, turkeys. I don't know if you know, but nearly all chickens mate naturally. So breeder chickens, they're called, the next generation is produced by natural mating. But turkeys, almost none are. Turkeys are artificially inseminated. So semen is collected from the male turkey, and then the females are inseminated. So when you have a Christmas turkey, there's been no turkey sex involved. There's been some artificial insemination of the female. This is a bull. This is a bull which is being allowed to get a little bit closer to proper sexual interaction, but not fully. It's being, in this case, it's effectively a teaser cow, and he is being allowed to almost mate, and then his semen is collected. This is more routine, the semen is collected. There's a cow there again to act as an interest, but the male is going nowhere near the female. Other species, this is an elephant. Never seen it done. It looks quite an epic thing to be done. This is a killer whale. So humans have started to really try and take control of the next step in a huge number of species. And the next step then is you need to inseminate the female. And often that involves a little bit of pseudo-stimulation, a little bit of taking the female a little bit along the route towards a mating, but not very far. In the sow, for instance, what you do with the sow is you, if she's receptive, you stimulate a bit of pressure on her back. And it's enough for this poor sow in this very unenriched environment to trigger some sexual behavior. So the back pressure test or the riding test, and if the female's receptive, she will say, yes, okay, I'll tolerate it. So this is a behavior that's widely used every day across the world for many hundreds of thousands of sows to test their receptivity to this. And then the next stage is very mechanistic. Some semen from the male is inserted in a straw, and it's held in place for a period of time so that the semen drains into the vagina, into the cervix, and into the uterus. And there is a whole industry based around bits of plastic for this. And you'll go on a farm and you'll see a whole series of sows standing with this semen artificial insemination going on. And for many sows, this is as close to a sexual interaction as they will ever have. And when you see it, in a way, it looks odd. I mean, it looks almost as if it should be unlawful, in a sense, you know, riding the sow and then inseminating the sow. But this is the norm. This is the norm of behaviors within this particular domain of sexual and reproductive control of pigs. In this case, it seems to me you're selling sex with glamour. I mean, you know, this is confused, isn't it? This is a mare being artificial inseminated. So for this mare, this is as close as she will be getting to any sexual interaction. She's been inseminated with the semen that was collected earlier in the slides. And this is the female turkey being inseminated. So what we've done with many species, we've taken sex out of the equation. Well, sex, if sex means an interaction between the male and the female, if it means some courtship, if it means some time, if it means some choice, if it means a repertoire of behaviours that are sort of preparatory to the activity, we've taken all of that out of the equation. We've bypassed that, we found the simplest, well, not simple, we found the quickest mechanism to get semen to meet an egg. And in a way, you might say, well, okay, well, that's a little bit unfortunate, but it's a tough reality. But I would question whether that's taking a huge portion of an animal's experiential possibilities away. But I can't force you to have that view. I think you need to judge it against what your expectations of an arc of a life would be. Your expectation would be that you would have some choice. You would choose partners. You would reject partners. You would choose the circumstances, the timing, etc. For animals, most of that is no longer a choice. It's mandated. The next thing is we even remove another layer. We even remove the actual place in which the egg and the sperm meet. In this case, we get some sperm, we get an egg, but they meet in a test tube, and this is embryo transfer. So we even take it so far away that the meeting between the gametes is not even within the animal anymore. It's in the laboratory, and then we put the fertilized ova back into the animal. And we take it even more than that. Sometimes we make it very efficient by superovulating. So in this cow, we superovulate with drugs that she produces many more oocysts, eggs, than she would normally do, so that we can get a lot of fertile eggs. We can get more fertile eggs out of a cow than at one moment that would be normal. And then we can implant them over many months. Surprisingly, you can freeze a fertilized embryo. And it can be viable for years, 20, 30, maybe 50 years, nobody really knows. As a non-developed, it's fertilized, but it's not developing. And then you can put it back into a cow later on. So this is sort of the bread and butter of veterinary reproductive, complex reproductive work. Vets train in recognizing the cyclic nature of the uterus. They train in recognizing when the ova are going to be ready for fertilization. These are sort of weird, but normal. They're weird in that what we've done is really very far away from the natural, but normal in that it's requested, it's asked for, it's commercially available. It's a mechanism for high value reproduction. But any discussion about mating between a bull and a cow is long gone now. We're now in the technical domain of timing and chemicals and hormones and that kind of thing. It can happen in sheep as well. In this case, it's actually being implanted directly, the ova are being directly implanted straight into the uterus in a sheep. Okay, and the next thing that we do is quite profound if you think about it. It's we irreversibly alter the reproductive organs of animals, but it's also universal. So some of you may have done this. Who's put rubber rings on sheep? Nobody. Yes. Okay.
Cow.
Cow. Okay. Rubber rings on tail or testicles? So this is, you may even find them in the field, these little rubber rings, but just think what they represent. And here are, you know, bare feet, so it's a sort of afternoon's activity, let's castrate all the goats. But when you think about it, it's quite odd. It's a very pronounced and profound restriction on an animal. Castrating it, neutering it. What you've done is taken ultimate control, taken away possibility for normal sexual functioning in that respect. But it's absolutely day to day. So the other thing, rather than just simply destroy it by rubber rings, destroy the testicles by constricting the blood supply, the other thing you can do is just profoundly damage them. This is a thing called a burditzo. You don't even open the scrotum, you just crush the spermatic cord there so that it can't function anymore. It's a form of vasectomy, but without any surgery involved. Have you seen this done? So this is very common in many parts of the world. You just simply crush the spermatic cord very hard. And there will be no successful mating now from this male animal. And then the routine thing that is happening every single day around the world for dogs, for cats, to a certain extent for other species, is spaying or neutering. Who's got a female dog or cat? And have they been neutered?
She was a long time ago.
A long time ago. So it's just perceived as the norm. If you've got a female cat and you don't want to have a litter at a certain age, at 4 months, 5 months, you take her to the vet and she's neutered. Same with a bitch. But you might be interested to know that actually bitch spaying is unlawful in many Scandinavian countries. We consider it absolutely normal, but in Norway and Sweden, it's unusual, bordering on illegal. You have to request it for some specific medical purpose. But it's day to day, it's bread and butter for many veterinary surgeons in this country, spaying of animals, or castration in this case. It doesn't have to be done in a fancy environment. When I was a vet in practice in different countries, I did spaying effectively on people. This is done on someone's kitchen table. It's such a routine operation that it can be done under heavy sedation, literally out in the field, and it's definitely done for farm animals that way. But even for dog and cat, it'll be done in the owner's home sometimes. But it's actually not a minor procedure, it's quite a significant procedure to be done. Here's a pig about to be castrated, no anaesthetic, sharp blade, cut into the scrotum, testicles gone. A lot of squealing, that's it. I mean, I'm not saying it's a good thing, but here's a calf being castrated here. I think it's a calf, it might even be, actually it's a goat, now that I look at it, there's a goat there as well. Anyway, that's being castrated just by open castration, just with a bucket of some disinfectant and just on the ground there. Horses, even horses are often castrated standing up, not anaesthetized, sedated, standing up. It's safer to do them standing, and you make an incision and you castrate them standing. So the reason I'm showing you these is not to sort of heroically show what veterinary procedures, but just to get you to think how these things are routine. They're actually quite odd, because they're a very profound change in an animal. You're taking away, one, the organ, two, the functionality, but three, the hormonal contribution to that animal's arc of life. When you take away the testicle, you take away one of the major producers of testosterone, so the behaviors change. So we use it for not only reproductive control, but also for behavioral change. So I'd just like to finish off with a few questions about love, because it's not something, strangely, that you hear much described by farmers. Do you? When you go to a farm, he doesn't say, I always use that ram, because a lot of the ewes, they love him, because he's really, you know, they love him. It's not, these are not words that are used on a farm. They might say he performs well, and he leaves a good number of lambs, and he doesn't go lame, and he's very effective, but the concept of emotional involvement between particularly farm animals, it does not really exist. But love is deeply embedded in the way that we think about life, but also in, I think, the way that we think about our sexual experience throughout life. It's very intimately connected with affection, with choice. And in animals, you can find 100 million images of animals appearing to show emotionally bonded activity. You can find it, I mean, it depends how you construct the picture, of course. I don't think they are actually holding hands, but but we take it for granted that emotional bonding between animals, it does exist. I think we are fairly confident that that's real. And animals will defend each other, they will fight for each other, they will work for each other, they will work hard to provide food for each other, they will work hard to find the right mate. Even if they're aliens. And as humans, we have a deep, profound culture of the link between sort of eroticism and human bonds. I mean, I could, you know, the world of the close association between affection, intimacy, and sex is almost infinite now in terms of what you can find on the internet. And it's historically, it's been reproduced in many, many complex ways. But I think this Schoenger painting shows it quite closely. It's clearly a sexual act happening, but it is also very intimate. It's also very personal. So I would just like to finish off by asking questions about whether what we've done with animals, which is very, very mechanistic, which is about reproduction, very often misses one of the key elements that we take for granted as humans, which will be that we will get on a cascade of chemicals, whether we wanted to or not. If you've been in love, or whatever you would like to call it, you will to a certain extent have been controlled by self-generated chemicals within your own body. I mean, they're known, it's known what they're called. But what's interesting is you can't create it. You can't go to the chemist, you can't go to Boots and say, oh, I need a bit of love, and they give you a tablet, because there ain't such a thing. I mean, you could go and get some testosterone, and you could go and get some dopamine and some estrogen. You could get all these things, but you can't get a tablet called love. You have to create that within your own self, and it's context dependent. You know, you have to have the right thing put in front of you. I'm not saying what that thing is. I mean, you could fall in love with someone or something utterly inappropriate, because that's in your head, and I mean head. So there is a chemical, at least partly recognized chemical basis for love. And whether animals have the same thing exactly is unclear, but the chemical basis is very clear. You can find the same chemical cascades, the same representation of love in animals. And it happens at the neural level. I mean, everything happens at the neural level. I mean, your fingers may move and your feet might walk, but all the experience is up here inside of your skull. It's the same for animals. But is it the same? And this is where the philosophical dilemmas start. Can we ascribe the same gut-wrenching emotions of love that we might experience to a starling or to a lizard? And this is where it gets very difficult for us to say yes or no, but I'm not going to force a view on you. I think you have to make your own view. But you can find the chemicals being active. You can trigger them to a certain point. You can go and buy an oxytocin nasal spray. And in America, some people use this as a part of their preparation for courtship. I'm not personally recommending it. I think your brain's quite capable of doing it itself if the conditions are right. And you could bring it down to sort of a mechanistic level. But it isn't like that. It's much more subtle, and it's much more fluctuant than that. It can be going very well, and it can be destroyed in an instant, because it's psychological. And I'm sure the same is true to a large degree in animals. So trying to reduce love and the relationship of love to affection, to intimacy, to animals is complex. And I think you're brave if you go too far. But I would like to propose that it's definitely something that should be discussed. You can go to the biochemical level. You can find where these agents act. But I'm not sure it helps you. I mean, that's great for understanding the mechanisms, but it's not good for understanding the outcomes, I don't think. Because one of the outcomes that we find as humans is if we are under the influence of these things, it alters our behaviours, and probably from an evolutionary point of view, it alters the behaviours in a successful reproductive way. But we don't think that. We think, I fancy this person, I want to spend time with them, and that ends up as being a family, or whatever it ends up, or a relationship, or whatever it ends up as being. So these are the words I started this talk with, I think, which are very mechanistic words, which are the common words we use in animals in relation to sex and reproduction. This is some of the things that we know happen amongst animals, but to quantify exactly what they are in human terms is difficult. Affection, bonding. Some animals, it seems closer and clearer for us that what they do are closer to our behaviours. And when we get to the primate level, some of the behaviours seem so close to what we do and what we don't do that it seems very unlikely that the emotional, the experiential is not very, in my view, very similar. I mean, we are very similar. We might not like to think it. And historically and religiously, the possibility that we were so close to animals had huge ramifications. But I think many people would accept that we're not so far in many, many aspects from animals. But when we reduce them to mechanistic production things, I think we lose a possibility to understand the wider implications of words like this. Bonding, pairing, I mean, these are about relationships, affection, love. Not often used in relation to animals, but I see there's a book that's got a whole chapter on animals and love, and that means between animals. Tenderness, fondness, infatuation, allegiance. And then we get into the things that are a bit more about the sexual aspects, ardour, amour. These are going into the across the border from affection into the more the physical aspects, rapture. So I haven't got any answers really as to whether animals see the world or feel the world like we do, but I suspect in many cases they're not far away. And a bit of appropriate anthropomorphism and putting ourselves prospectively into their position would do no harm in understanding, I think, the world. Thank you.
We've got time for brief questions. Anybody got a question to ask here?